Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. On June 30th, China passed a national security law for Hong Kong. The bill criminalizes dissent and, for the first time, establishes national security agencies. So what has happened since then? Well, on Monday, at least 10 activists were arrested, including 23-year-old Agnes Chow. According to the BBC, Chow joined a youth-led movement when she was just 15 to protest plans to implement, quote, moral and national education in public schools. She went on to become a key figure in the Umbrella Movement, and she was arrested on Monday for, quote, colluding with foreign forces under the law. On Facebook, Agnes Chow wrote that this was her fourth and most terrifying arrest. Other prominent figures were also arrested, including Jimmy Lai, a 71-year-old media mogul. Jimmy Lai owns the Apple Daily. It's a newspaper, and their offices were raided. Reporters live streamed the arrest. Joining us with the latest is Wilfred Chan, contributing writer for The Nation and former journalist based in Hong Kong, where he covered the Umbrella Movement and its aftermath. Hi, Wilfred. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rose. Thanks.
Well, it's great to have you, Wilfred. Last time you were on the show, this new law had not yet been approved. So please remind us, why did China impose this law on Hong Kong in the first place?
Well, this is not rule of law, which is what they claim, but really rule by law. It's a blank check for the government to suppress all dissent against it. And it comes after over a year of the greatest scale of pro-democracy uprising that has been seen in Hong Kong's contemporary history. And the ironic thing is that the protests originally began as a way to try to stop something that was a milder version of what we see now, this draconian national security law. Hong Kongers have long valued the legal separation between the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region and the rest of mainland China. That's what makes Hong Kong a place where there could be free speech, where there could be protests, where you could stand up against your local officials. And now that's all coming to an end.
This is really important because we spoke in depth about the piece you wrote for The Nation in May. It's an excellent piece, The Infinite Heartbreak of Loving Hong Kong. And in that piece, as you point out, you write, until recently, all of these people working in Hong Kong, we're talking about migrants, refugees, queer folks, sex workers, and other activists, they were able to relatively work freely in Hong Kong. They were able to speak critically of authorities without fearing government reprisal. So tell us a little bit more about that and what has really changed.
That's right. And people have been protesting for the right to identify politically, to be someone with views that are outside of the mainstream that can be challenging against authorities. And for the vast majority of Hong Kong's contemporary existence, that has been the case, where people can be out in the open identifying as pro-sex worker, as pro-migrant, as pro-democracy, all of these things that are not really tolerated in mainland China. And, what's happening now is China is trying to create the Hong Kong of its own vision, which is a hyper-capitalistic outpost for global trade and finance without the messiness of politics and dissent.
Why now?
Well, you know, I think it reflects the fracturing that's happening on the global level. When Hong Kong became the special administrative region in 1997, the world was in a very different place. You had this idea that maybe China was about to integrate into this global, liberal, Western-led economic order. That is no longer how people feel. China feels that it has more leverage. It feels that it no longer needs to cooperate with international norms, with these notions of liberal democracy. And in many ways, liberal democracy itself is having a credibility crisis when you look at what's happening in the United States, when you look at the way that the U.S. government has failed people here in the U.S., when you look at the way that the Trump administration is actually saying a lot of similar things to what the Hong Kong government is saying in terms of trying to delay elections and so on and so forth. China sees this as a golden opportunity to consolidate its authoritarian vision over Hong Kong and knows that the West and the rest of the world is not really in a place to push back.
So let's talk more about this law. It passed on June 30th. It criminalizes dissent. It, for the first time, it establishes national security agencies in Hong Kong. What else do we need to know about this law?
Well, we hear a lot about the celebrities and the prominent activists such as Agnes Chow and Jimmy Lai, who have been arrested under the law. We hear a lot about Joshua Wong, the de facto face of the protest movement, even though he's not really considered a protest leader by folks on the ground in Hong Kong these days. What we won't hear as much about are the ordinary folks. There's a story that just came out of an IT clerk within the Hong Kong police who was arrested under the law for uploading information about police movements to Hong Kong's version of Reddit, a popular forum. And so he violated this national security law. There's my friends who are deleting their social media accounts, who are afraid to write publicly in newspapers, to speak out. Everyone's changing their behavior, whether they want to admit it or not. And this is what's really scary, is beyond these dramatic headlines, is daily life is changing and people are becoming more and more terrified.
So, as you said, there have been some high-profile activists arrested. I mentioned Agnes Chow in the intro. Why? What can you tell us about the timing of these arrests? They happened on Monday.
And it's absolutely to send a message. China is not trying to suggest that the national security law is merely hypothetical, but is intent in showing its full force. It's a kind of shock and awe strategy that the Chinese government, with the help of the Hong Kong government, is employing right now. You know, Agnes Chow has not been on the front lines of these protests. Jimmy Lai is not even considered to be a particularly influential commentator by many of the younger folks in the protest movement these days. Martin Lee, another person targeted by the pro-democracy movement, is considered part of the old guard. But China needs to have these figureheads that it can point to as these as folks to make an example out of.
Right, because they're getting the most attention. I mean, every international outlet has articles about this, and there are so many videos showing Agnes in handcuffs, reporters live-streamed Jimmy Lai's arrest. So what can you tell? Yeah. What's not getting attention? What are you hearing from your contacts and friends in Hong Kong?
Well, people have to think of a new way to resist, and everything that protesters did has now basically been made illegal. A song that protesters wrote called Glory to Hong Kong is now banned, right? Even making fun of the Chinese flag can land you 3 years in prison. All the routes are being closed off. Even journalists don't really know what the line is. A journalist asked Chief Executive Carrie Lam at a press conference recently whether just reporting the facts could be considered violation of this national security law. And she replied, it's not a question for me standing here to give you a guarantee of what you may or may not do in the days and weeks and years ahead. That's a direct quote. And that really goes to show that what they're trying to do is not create clarity, but an atmosphere of fear. And you can imagine that if these prominent folks are feeling the heat, that ordinary folks have far less leverage to continue dissenting in Hong Kong.
Emily Fang, who is based in Beijing, she's an NPR reporter. She reports that textbooks are being censored, students are being arrested for their social media posts, teachers are being investigated for, quote, improper speech. She quoted a secondary school teacher whose principal put her under investigation after parents alleged that she described Hong Kong police as riot police to students in an online lecture. She said, quote, "We will not be allowed to teach about civil disobedience in the fall semester, but we are expected to teach about the national security law," end quote. She was cleared after providing a video recording of the lecture, but she asked to remain anonymous because she still fears for her job.
That's right. And there's reports about universities actually pulling classes as well. People at the Hong Kong University Law School, you know, one of the most prestigious institutions in the territory, feeling like they can't teach the classes that they were going to. There's a video I was just watching where police stroll into a cafe known to be pro-democracy. This is just a place where people hang out and drink coffee without a warrant, without any notice, without consent, and just hang out behind the cash register until the owner comes back and they start making fun of him. I mean, this is a pure police state. It's not an exaggeration, and we're watching it helplessly.
Emily Fang with NPR also reports that these new powers allow authorities to order internet service providers to censor content. Facebook, Twitter, and Google are companies that said they will not comply with data requests. She reports that some companies are already leaving Hong Kong altogether.
Yes, and it remains to be seen how the big tech companies will navigate this. Google isn't complying with the data request right now. They're directing Hong Kong police's request to the U.S. Department of Justice. But, you know, it's an uneasy position for a tech company like Google. And I think it's part of this larger dynamic where you see the world splitting into this new Cold War dynamic where the only two options are the U.S. government or the Chinese government. You know, we're seeing that drama with TikTok. We're seeing this play out, and Hong Kong is caught right in the middle.
Today, we're speaking with Wilfred Chan, contributing writer for The Nation and a former journalist based in Hong Kong, where he covered the Umbrella Movement and its aftermath. If you have any questions or comments on this, Wilfred will be with us for the next 10 minutes or so. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Wilfred, we've also been reading some reports about, you know, very young activists feeling like they have no choice but to flee the country or to flee Hong Kong.
Yeah. Right now, a lot of people see no way out as a young person living in Hong Kong. And some folks are lucky enough to have multiple nationalities. Most Hong Kong folks born in Hong Kong before 1997 are also considered British national overseas, which is a special type of passport created during British colonialism. And what's happening now is the British government is offering holders of this so-called BNO passport 5 years plus an extra year to work and possibly have a route to citizenship in the UK. So people are looking to that. A lot of folks are looking to Taiwan as the closest cultural analog to their lives in Hong Kong. And that's another government that is also extending a welcome mat to Hong Kongers who feel politically persecuted. So it's very sad for a lot of folks who can't afford to leave and have to be there no matter what happens to Hong Kong. And I think those are the folks that I'm trying to center in this analysis and figure out what's going to happen to them.
Right, because we know that they put so much on the line already. They were, I mean, how long did the Umbrella Movement, or when did it begin?
Well, the Umbrella Movement is the predecessor to the current uprising. And the Umbrella Movement was in 2014, lasted 79 days. But the current uprising has been going on for more than a year. And, you know, throughout this entire time, protesters who were arrested were facing as much as 10 years in jail for, rioting, which is the term that the police use, right? So think about what it takes for these 15, 16-year-old students to feel that their best hope at having some say over their own future is to face down these militarized cops in the streets and risk 10 years in prison than to just get with the program and, you know, go to school and look for a job. I mean, it speaks to the desperation in this city. And what's scary is that 10 years, I mean, we're now looking at possibly life in prison under this national security law. Part of this national security law means that protesters or anyone charged can be whisked across the border to face trial in mainland China, where the conviction rate is 99.9%. I mean, it's an extremely opaque system where you don't have your lawyer there. You don't have any recourse if they decide that you're going to spend the rest of your life in jail.
Wilfred, what's your assessment of media coverage about what's happening in Hong Kong, specifically the young people, the movement, and what's at stake for them?
The media coverage is sometimes frustrating for me. And I think it has to do with that new Cold War dynamic that I mentioned, which is that everything gets funneled into either pro-West or pro-Hong Kong. And, you know, I'm currently based in New York City. I've witnessed the protests here. I've seen what this government has done and not done to help people during this crisis that we're having. And it's very frustrating to see the protests constantly talked about as a battle between freedom, implying the West, and authoritarianism, meaning the East, when actually there are so many similarities between the oppression that protesters face on both sides of the ocean. So I'd like to see more coverage and more analysis that links the problems that we're facing in Hong Kong and we're facing over here together, looks at these broader cross-border structural issues that are causing all of this dissent and oppression in the first place.
Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm glad your guest is at Wilfred.
Yes.
Has brought up the issue that democracy is in danger there and here. Do you think that China has been emboldened by, one, the recklessness of Trump and the actions of Trump? In other words, you know, hey, there's nobody going to be standing up for real democracy.
Absolutely. I think that China loves to play the double standards card. And you see it, you know, even in late May, when the protests really began to break out over here, the Chinese foreign ministry was almost gleeful in pointing out that, you know, the U.S. is now getting a taste of its own medicine, right? Basically saying, see, you have protests too. So in essence, justifying their own crackdown on the Hong Kong protests. And so the more that the U.S. undercuts its own rhetoric about, you know, the West as being a beacon of freedom and democracy, the more China sees no problem with doing whatever it's doing. And in some ways, you know, logically, they're not wrong. But it really speaks to the need for these movements on both sides of the pond to hold all our governments to account, to demand better, so that these governments can't use our movements against each other, and they can't just point to other states as scapegoats for their own violence and their own neglect.
Well, thank you for the call. Thanks for the call, Bill. What are the demands of the activists, and how have they changed as a result of this law?
Well, the original five demands were actually extremely humble, you know, and it's very important to clarify that independence is not one of the demands of this protest movement, right? Protesters initially asked for the Hong Kong government to withdraw a so-called extradition bill, which would have allowed for the extradition of Hong Kongers to face trial in mainland China. Of course, that's now happening with the national security law. But that was the thing that initially brought people into the streets. And after police responded with tear gas and rubber bullets and riot control weapons, protesters added the demands of an independent investigation into police brutality, releasing the arrested protesters, dropping this label of riots that could land protesters 10 years in prison, and finally, democracy, which is the thing that was promised to the Hong Kong people by the Beijing government ever since the handover in 1997. So these are not radical demands. And the fact that you see the situation getting to where it is now is not because the protesters have been making outrageous demands or advocating for secession, but really because the government refuses to meet protesters where they are to engage with the people's concerns.
Let's talk a little bit about the politics. I'm reading from Bloomberg right now. China said it will sanction 11 Americans in retaliation for similar measures imposed by the United States. The list does not include members of the Trump administration. The list does include Senators Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, Tom Cotton, and Pat Toomey. There were photos on Twitter of a few activists meeting with Marco Rubio, a conservative senator from Florida.
Yep.
What are your thoughts about this? What are the ramifications of these protesters meeting with U.S. politicians?
Well, and here I'm speaking for myself and not for other folks. There's the protest movement in Hong Kong is ideologically diverse. And I've been very clear from the beginning that I think this is a bad idea. I don't know what Hong Kongers have actually won from lobbying folks like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz. I think it undercuts Hong Kong's movement against police brutality in terms of the moral message. And I think that it creates this consequence that we're seeing right now where the Chinese government believes it has a rightful pretext to crack down on this so-called foreign collusion. What these protesters were asking for in these meetings with U.S. officials were the sanctions that you're now seeing against certain Hong Kong and Chinese officials, and for a law, the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, which basically would you see it happening now, but the U.S. is decoupling, no longer treating Hong Kong as a separate region from China for the purposes of trade and foreign policy. And this is supposed to be something that, would send a strong message against China. But I think what it's really done is just exacerbate this new Cold War dynamic and made it even harder for the two sides to come to some kind of agreement about how Hong Kong could continue to enjoy a peaceful existence. And granted, the argument is that there needs to be some consequences, right? That we can't just sit and watch as China continues to ramp up its authoritarianism. And to that, I agree, but I disagree that using the U.S. government's policies is the way to go.
Wilfred, obviously it's hard for you to know where this is going, but given that Agnes Chow wrote on her Facebook page, this was her most terrifying arrest. She was released, Jimmy Lai was released, the others were released. What's next for activists?
It's really hard to say. But one thing that the movement has been cultivating throughout the last year is a leaderless praxis. In other words, just not depending so much on these well-known figureheads. And that has its advantages and disadvantages. You have, on one hand, a movement that is more diffuse and hard to stamp out. On the other hand, it means that sometimes it's a bit chaotic, right? I mean, that goes with any kind of horizontal organization like this. So Hong Kongers will find new ways to resist. Hong Kongers are resourceful. They are dispersed across borders. I'm a Hong Konger living in New York City. I'm trying to understand what my role is in this new paradigm. I don't know. But the point is that it doesn't end with the arrests of these well-known activists. Certainly, these activists will continue to inspire folks even from behind bars.
Well, Wilfred, thank you so much for your reporting. We'd love to have you back. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Wilfred Chan is a contributing writer for The Nation and a former journalist based in Hong Kong, where he covered the umbrella movement and its aftermath. You can find a number of stories about what is happening on the ground in Hong Kong at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we will talk about the Trump administration's plans to sabotage the election, and we'll find out what can be done about it. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about the Trump administration's plans to sabotage the election. Last Friday, the head of the U.S. Postal Service, a major GOP donor, ousted top executives. Mail sorting machines are being removed without explanation, and mail is taking longer than usual in several parts of the country. So, we are less than 3 months away from the election. What can be done about this? David Daley is a journalist and senior fellow for Fair Vote. He's author of two books, including Rat Effed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy, and his latest, Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
Well, great to have you. There are so many moving parts to all of this, so let's just go over each one. Last Friday, the U.S. Postal Service broke news that Louis DeJoy, a major GOP donor to Trump and the recently appointed Postmaster General, issued a major overhaul of the agency. It included ousting top executives from key posts and reshuffling more than a dozen officials. Kristen Clark, who's the executive director of Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, called it a Friday night massacre. Excuse me, can you comment on this and tell us the latest?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, it was yet another Friday night massacre. We've gotten really used to these news dumps from the Trump administration during these weeks. Louis DeJoy is the new Postmaster General. He's only been on the job for 2 months. He is a major Republican donor. He is a major Donald Trump donor. And a week ago, under cover of a weekend evening, he essentially either reassigned or displaced 23 executives at the post office, including some true veterans. And among these targets were two of the key executives who oversee the daily operations at the Postal Service. That's not all that's been happening there, however. DeJoy, in his 2 months on the job, has banned overtime. He has told carriers to leave mail behind at distribution centers. So you have mail piling up. There are reports this week in Vice and elsewhere about sorting machines that speed mail processing being removed, hundreds of them being taken out of service around the country. The post office has notified Pennsylvania, Michigan, Washington State, and many others that they may not be able to deliver ballots on time. And we have also seen that over the years, the post office has long delivered ballots at bulk rate, but with first-class speed. They have told states that they will not do this, that you must use first class for a ballot, or who knows when it's going to get there.
Okay, so that's a lot. As you say, Vice reports that the USPS is removing mail sorting machines from facilities around the country without any official explanation or reason given. Do you have any idea how unusual is this?
According to the union officials that have been quoted in these stories, this is highly unusual. They can't understand why this is happening. Especially why this would be happening in the months before a presidential election, in which it's possible somewhere between 150 to 180 million ballots may be moving through the mail. This is not a time to be taking hundreds of expensive multi-million dollar pieces of machinery out of service. There are reports that these are simply being destroyed, and there is no official explanation as to why it is happening and why it is happening now.
Will Bunch has a piece in the Philadelphia Inquirer. He writes that the USPS is warning Pennsylvania that some mail ballots might not be delivered on time because the state's deadlines are too tight for its delivery standards, prompting officials to ask the state Supreme Court to extend the deadlines to avoid disenfranchising voters.
This is what is so complicated. 34 states around the country, including Pennsylvania, require that ballots have arrived by Election Day. It's not okay for those ballots simply to have been postmarked by Election Day. They have to be with the Department of Elections in your state by the time November 3rd is over. If that ballot shows up on November 4th, it's going to land in the trash. So the risk that we have by the mail slowing down would be hundreds of millions of Americans sending in ballots the week before an election and not knowing whether those ballots are going to count or whether they're going to arrive on November 4th, November 5th, November 6th, and end up in a garbage can. We have already seen from other states, Wisconsin's primary back in April, New York's primary, we have seen that too often ballots are piled up in post offices even after elections are over. If we want to guard against this, the post office absolutely needs to be fully funded. This is an extraordinary effort at voter suppression and disenfranchisement.
Can you repeat this? In 34 states, the ballots need to arrive by when?
By Election Day.
So if
your ballot is postmarked Election Day, but arrives on November 5th, it's not going to be counted in 34 states. States are able to make their own laws about this. And the U.S. Supreme Court, back in April, when Democrats in Wisconsin attempted to extend that deadline because of the pandemic, the Supreme Court of the United States in a 5-4 decision said, no, you can't do that. We are going to hold up this a law that your ballots have to have been in the hands of your local election officials on Election Day. So what you might see in the day after the election is litigation beginning underway in state after state that, again, slows down the results and throws additional chaos and allows a president who has been willing to make wild and unfounded claims about the voter fraud to question the legitimacy of the entire election. There is an awful lot at stake here.
Right, and that's almost guaranteed to happen because he's already doing that. All right, so we'll talk about funding in a minute. So 34 states, in 34 states, your ballot has to arrive by Election Day or it will not be counted. This is very problematic because NPR had a piece yesterday about a new investigation from APM Reports. They analyzed first-class mail delivery data and found that mail service in critical swing states is worse than a year ago. So what is happening is mail delivery is coming up short. What if these people in these 34 states do not get their ballot in time?
They won't count. And these states include Arizona, Georgia, Maine, Michigan, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. These are important battleground states for this election. And what you might have are Americans who drop their ballot in the mail, who think that their voice is being counted and heard, But that ballot could arrive on November 4th or November 5th and simply not count. We don't know how many ballots that might affect. But if you are voting by mail, you have to begin this process really early. And there are too many states, and this is what the Postal Service was warning people about in states like Pennsylvania, because the law in Pennsylvania allows you to request a ballot about a week before the election. And the post office is saying, if you send somebody a ballot a week before the election, we can't guarantee that that ballot is going to arrive on time and count.
According to this APM report, thousands of ballots did not reach voters in Wisconsin for this year's April primary. This is just one example.
It's just one example. And the problem when, there are multiple problems here. But when ballots that are requested by voters do not reach voters, it forces those citizens to make a decision. Do I want to go to the polls in the middle of a pandemic? Because if you can't vote by mail because you didn't get that ballot, you have no choice but then to go vote in person. And what we have seen in Wisconsin, in Georgia, in so many other states, are that local election officials are not able or not willing to open up enough in-person voting precincts to accommodate the demand of voters. We all saw the lines in Wisconsin. We saw the lines in Georgia, 6-7 hours long as a work day for some people, to stand outside in the middle of a pandemic masked in order to cast their ballot. So many of those people could well have been in that line because the ballot that they requested via the mail simply didn't get there.
What does the data tell us about when people turn in their ballots?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think that the post office is concerned that most people consider this a process to do sort of in the last 10 days before an election. And what they're saying is that's not going to be enough time. And in so many states, the process of requesting a ballot involves multiple steps. It could involve mailing in an application or going online and requesting that the state mail you an application to apply for an absentee ballot. So you might go online, request an application, wait for that application to arrive in your mail, send it back in, you have to wait for the state to receive it, mail you back a ballot, and then you mail the ballot back in. Mm-hmm. Now, that could be a 4 or 5 week process, given the kind of delays that we are looking at. That means if you're not thinking about this by the beginning of October, you are potentially putting your vote at risk.
Okay, and today's August 14th. So this just speaks to the importance of the media constantly talking about this, doing public service announcements, letting people know, as you said, to, if you don't live in a place like California where by default we're going to get our mail-in ballot, which that should be the policy in all 50 states.
It should.
Right. So you have to apply for that. In some states, right, Dave, you actually have to prove, you have to give a reason why you want to vote from home.
And some states have said that a pandemic is not a good enough excuse. Other states, if you want to vote via mail, you might have to have two witnesses attest to the validity of your ballot, or even get it notarized in Oklahoma.
Notarized?
Notarized. So this is a different process in every state. If you are looking to vote by mail for the first time, you'd better understand what the process is in your state and have a full understanding of how long it might take. This is not something we can begin around Halloween. It's something you've got to be thinking about really at the beginning of October, if not sooner.
Right. Really, right now. The other thing that's concerning is there have been a couple studies showing that young people aren't really familiar with mail-in voting. And I'm thinking about the college students who are not going out of state, for example. They're going to be home, and they need to change their address to make sure that they still get their ballot.
This is the trick. If you have not voted by mail or absentee before, it can be a harder process than you think as far as being sure you have met all of the requirements, meaning is it witnessed, is it notarized if it has to be, have you signed in all of the right places? Sometimes there's multiple places on a ballot where you have to sign. Have you stuffed it back in the security envelope the right way? There are so many things that can trip you up along the way, and it is why there is a higher disqualification rate for vote-by-mail ballots for young people, first-time users, and people of color.
Today we are speaking with David Daley about the Trump administration's plans to sabotage the election. There are many moving parts to this. If you have any questions for David, now is a good time to call 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. David is a senior fellow for Fair Vote. His latest book is Unrigged: How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. Do you have any other tips for people to make sure that they get their ballot and then turning it in on time? NPR also had a piece recently called Ballot Drop Boxes Are Becoming the Latest Front in the Voting Legal Fight.
Yes, I think that's for a good reason. Multiple states are attempting to set up drop boxes where if you get a mail-in ballot, you can simply drop it off. This has been a very useful technique in states like Oregon and Washington, states that do all of their voting by mail. They use drop boxes routinely. When Pennsylvania attempted to add drop boxes, they found themselves on the receiving end of a lawsuit from the Republican National Committee, saying that this was illegal for them to do, and challenging that right. In Ohio right now, the Republican Secretary of State is allowing some drop boxes, but he's attempting to limit it to one drop box per county. So that's a start, but it's hardly sufficient. If the post office is not going to be able or willing to ensure that ballots can be delivered on time, drop boxes would be a perfect and easy opportunity for this. And what we're seeing in state after state is that this too is now becoming politicized and under attack, especially by Republicans.
Most city halls have drop boxes. You can drop off your ballot at most city halls, right?
It depends on the state you are in. It is a complicated process, and election law really varies by state. So wherever you are, it's important to check and see what your options are as far as returning a ballot.
So you're saying in some states you can't even return your ballot to the elections office at City Hall?
I would imagine that there are some states where you cannot. I mean, I would also imagine that there are some states in which city halls are some towns in which city halls aren't even open because of the pandemic.
Right, because of
I mean, I'm calling from a Massachusetts town, and you know, I walked past our town hall yesterday. It's still not open for public business. So there's a lot happening here at once as far as state voting laws, but also how we conduct an election in the middle of a pandemic.
Oh my gosh, and we're just so close. I mean, it's less than 3 months away. Let's take a couple calls before we end. Let's go to Gary in San Francisco. Hi, Gary. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Yes, I'm a union member, and I'm wondering who are the people dismantling the equipment in the processing centers? Are they union members? and what are the postal unions doing about this, and how can we help? I'm ready to go on strike.
Wow. Do you work for the USPS?
No, I'm a union member. I work in social services.
Oh, okay. Well, thank
you. I'm ready to go on strike in solidarity.
All right. Well, thanks for the great question, David.
It's a great question. We know about this because unions and union members have been coming forward and telling us about it. And they have shared documents. They have shared specific numbers and letters, and photos. That is how we know that this is going on. I do not know who specifically is taking these machines physically out of operation, but certainly there is a broad reduction in the number of these machines going on nationwide. There's a document from back in May that Vice received, and it's called Equipment Reduction. And, it breaks down specifically machine after machine based on region, based on facility that the Postal Service is looking to take out of service.
Yeah, and just for a little more information, Vice reports that 19 mail sorting machines from 5 processing facilities across the U.S. have already been removed or are scheduled to be removed. Even to local union officials, USPS has not announced any policy, explained why they're doing this, what will happen, and the workers who use them. Nor has management provided a rationale for dismantling and removing the machines from the facility. Iowa Postal Workers Union President Kimberly Carroll said, quote, "I'm not sure you're going to find an answer for why the machines are being removed because we haven't figured that out either." So it sounds like the workers don't even know.
I think that's right. This is clearly coming from at the top. And, sometimes we just have to believe our own eyes, right? I mean, this president has been conducting an assault on vote by mail now for months. It is only to be expected that that assault on vote by mail now moves into a wholesale assault on the post office, which you need if you're going to conduct an election by mail, let alone the number of Americans who count on the post office for prescription medication or checks or their businesses or rural America that sees it as a lifeline to the rest of the nation. That is what is under assault here for the purposes of trying to undermine a presidential election.
Leslie writes in, are there laws that protect the U.S. Postal Service operations? How can the Postmaster General of the United States be charged and removed from office for harm to the operations? Can he be sued? Can he be charged by Congress?
I certainly wish we were seeing hearings in the House of Representatives on this right now. Instead, the Democrats in the House have taken the rest of the month off, it appears. It would be wonderful to see them attempting to conduct a fact-finding investigation here and hollering as loudly as they can about it. The Postmaster General could certainly be removed by the Board of Governors of the Postal Service, but those are also Trump appointees.
Well, The Hill reports that on August 3rd, the House Oversight and Reform Committee asked the postmaster, Louis DeJoy, to answer questions at an upcoming hearing about these concerns. Chairwoman Carolyn Maloney announced the committee sent a letter to DeJoy asking for his testimony on September 17th to examine operation changes to the post office. So it looks like this is going to happen, but not until next month.
You had folks from the Postal Service on the Hill back in August, and they took those hearings so seriously that I believe that was on a Thursday, and the next night you had the Friday night massacre of all of these executives. Mm-hmm. If Democrats in Congress think it's appropriate to wait until September 17th, less than 6 weeks before a presidential election, to conduct these hearings, I would suggest that they need to have a little more urgency.
Yeah, okay, well, we will keep an eye on that one. One other thing I wanted to ask you before we have to say goodbye. CNN reports that a federal judge in Pennsylvania told the Trump campaign and the Republican Party that they must produce produce evidence that they have vote-by-mail fraud in the state by Friday. The judge's order in a high-profile case about vote-by-mail essentially forces the Trump campaign to try to back up Trump's false claims about massive voter fraud and postal voting.
It's wonderful news. They have never been able to document any of those claims. I mean, I think back to the Voter Integrity Commission that the Vice President and Kris Kobach headed up not long after the 2016 election, which disbanded, unable to approve essentially a single instance of voter fraud. If you look at studies from the states that do vote by mail in Oregon and Washington, tens of millions of ballots that are processed, a small handful of questionable cases. It is so infinitesimal as to barely register. We do not have a voting fraud problem in this country. What we have is a problem with officials, too often almost entirely Republican officials, who are willing to exploit myths and fear about vote by mail in order to undermine faith in vote by mail, in order to justify voter ID bills or voting list purges or any of the other barriers to the ballot box that have been constructed over the course of this last decade, especially in order to keep a party in power, even though they have a minority of votes.
David, we're going to have you back. I'm feeling like we need to do a show about this once a week because this really needs urgency. 30 seconds. Steve said he tried calling the White House about this. The comment line is closed. They're not taking messages. What can people do about this? What do you think the Democrats should do about this? 30 seconds.
Democrats need to be hollering about this. There need to be hearings on the Hill. There needs to be real urgency. If you are a voter, you ought to be, and you plan on voting by mail, you need to be thinking right now about how you are going to get that ballot and how you're going to return that ballot. And if you are able, and if it is safe to do early in-person voting in your locality, you might also think about that.
Well, we're going to cover this regularly. Thank you so much for all of your work. David Daley is a journalist and author of the book Unrigged. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.